Welcome back. Here in the second hour of the program, Mark Tooley will join us in just a moment. We're going to talk about the influence of African Methodists on the United Methodist Church. We'll also talk about the recent General Conference, third largest Protestant denomination in the United States. Mark Tooley will join us. Then John Leo from U.S. News and World Report. We're going to talk about a column he wrote in the latest issue of that news magazine titled Pain in the Heartland. We're going to be discussing this book that's making the rounds, and it's by Thomas Frank, called What's the Matter with Kansas? Frank is a little mystified as to why people of the heartland are often voting not in the interest of their pocketbook, but in the interest of values. John Leo will clear up the confusion for us there. And then to round off today's second hour of the program, Joe Starrs will join us. We're going to talk about pro-choice Roman Catholic politicians and the Republican National Convention. You may have seen the ad wherein the pro-choice Roman Catholic politicians, Republican and Democrat, are not only pictured and named, but their bishops are also named, and their bishops' email addresses are provided. This is a story that's not going away. In the third hour of the program, open lines for your questions and your comments. I'm going to talk about in the third hour something, during that hour of open lines, something that I think that, well, it happened last night at the Republican National Convention, and I don't think it should have happened. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but we will play some audio of what took place there, and I don't think it took it. I think it was completely inappropriate. You'll find out what it is. Then we'll also hear from President Bill Clinton. He spoke recently at a religious gathering talking about values voters and advising his audience not to be taken in by these notions that everyone, that anyone can corner the market on the truth. We're going to see what he really means when he talks about, and he quotes from St. Paul, we all see through a mirror dimly, none of us can claim to have the full truth. We'll just play out the logic of the former president's thinking there, and I'd like to point out how common it is, that very logic in the Christian church today. People who want no truck with President Bill Clinton believe exactly what he believes when it comes to truth. And, oh, there's another quote there that you'll hear of the president, the former president, talking about how he believes everything in the Bible is true. He believes everything in the Bible is true, but he doesn't believe that we can know what that truth is, which is also a very common belief among Christians. In fact, it is really the definition of what a lot of evangelicals mean when they call themselves Bible-believing. Oh, they'll tell you they believe everything in the Bible is true, as long as you don't discuss with them what those truths are. Then they'll say, well, you know, you have your interpretation, and I have my interpretation, and mine isn't necessarily true. Neither is yours necessarily true. Maybe we're both right. It's kind of the Clinton position on the inspiration of Scripture. We'll talk about that in the third hour of the program. Mark Tooley is our guest. He's director of the United Methodist Action Committee for the Institute on Religion and Democracy based in Washington, D.C., and he's author of an article in the latest Touchstone magazine titled Light from the Dark Continent. Mark, welcome back.
Always good to be with you.
Well, you know better than I do that the United Methodist Church recently had a general conference. What would the outcome of that conference have been were it not for the influence of African Methodists?
Well, about 20% of the church lived outside the U.S., mostly in Africa, and if it were not for that presence, almost certainly the church this year would have softened its official disapproval of homosexuality, and very possibly this year, if not in past years, it would have gone ahead and begun ordaining practicing homosexuals into the ministry and perhaps even sanctioning same-sex unions in its churches.
Before we get into the specifics on the African Methodists and their influence for the good, give us a brief overview of how the April-May General Conference of the United Methodist Church did come out.
Well, the governing convention of the church met, as you mentioned, several months ago and voted once again to reaffirm the church's teachings on marriage and sex, saying the church disapproves of homosexual practice. The clergy have to be celibate if single, monogamous if married, and the clergy and local churches may not celebrate same-sex unions, and also the bureaucracy of the church nationally and locally is prohibited from funding any kind of pro-homosexuality advocacy. And on almost all of those issues, the margins were at least slightly larger than when the last General Conference met 4 years ago.
Were there any notable compromises that you detected in that General Conference?
On this issue, there were not. The Liberals, realizing they could not win overtly, proposed several seemingly harmless semantic compromises that would have had the effect of softening or diluting the church's stance on sex and marriage, and those were all defeated by narrow margins, but they were all defeated.
Now, that's not, I mean, that's good news that due largely to the influence of Third World Methodists, the United Methodist Church in America is more or less staying the course, but let's talk about that course. The difference between what the United Methodist Church puts on paper and what it permits in practice on these issues of sexuality. What does it put on paper, but what does it permit in practice?
Well, on paper, of course, we don't allow any practicing homosexual clergy. But in practice, the west coast of the church, which is the most liberal part of the church and which comprises about 4% of the denomination, they practice a don't ask, don't tell policy for the most part. So we can assume that in California and elsewhere in the West Coast, there are practicing homosexual clergy. But as long as they don't openly admit to it, their bishops don't act against them.
So in other words, they could, the church officials in that area who practice the don't ask, don't tell policy with regard to the sexuality of the clergy, could say that they're technically in compliance.
That's
it's
right.
just that they are willfully ignorant of anyone's sexual orientation or practice.
That's right.
So, where does that leave the church on these issues when it says one thing on paper but permits in practice just the opposite, Mark?
Well, it means we're going to continue to battle intensely over these issues for many more years. However, I am very hopeful for the long term, in that demographically the liberal side of the church does not have a lot to look forward to. I mentioned the whole western part of this church, which includes the West Coast and the Rocky Mountain states, now comprises only 4% of the church's membership. A majority of the church now either lives in the South or the overseas, and the only growing parts of the church are basically overseas and a few parts of the South. So the conservative parts are growing, the liberal parts are shrinking, and I just don't see much future for those who are revisionist in their theology and who especially want to change the church's teachings on marriage and sex.
Do you foresee a day, Mark, when not only will there be no gain in ground for the liberal element in the United Methodist Church, but in fact you might be able to turn back the gains that they have made in the last three decades? In other words, where you could, according to church law, enforce some kind of compliance to the official teaching on sexuality, even in liberal areas of the church?
Well, even in most liberal areas of the church law is mostly enforced. But what will be key in the next 4 years is whether that enforcement starts to happen on the West Coast. Local regions of the church have a lot of autonomy, but the church's highest court, which is our ecclesial version of a Supreme Court, comprised of nine people, and we elected several new members at this last General Conference. So there's now a 6-3 conservative majority on that judicial council, and if they decide to start acting against the autonomy of, say, the Western jurisdiction, I think that would set off a great deal of panic among liberals who would start to say to themselves, well, if we're losing our autonomy, maybe we no longer belong in this denomination.
We have talked about this many times, Mark, but I'd like you to outline it again, and that is, and you talk about it in the Touchstone piece too, the gulf between the leadership of the United Methodist Church and the local churches, the people in the pew and the governing bodies of the church.
That's right. Polls show that about 65 or 70% of Methodists are theologically conservative, having orthodox views on the scriptures and who God is. But the permanent bureaucracy of the church, the agencies of the church, are almost completely controlled by liberals. Most of the seminaries are. And I would say certainly at least half of the U.S. bishops, and probably more than that, would be on the liberal side.
So why, again, with that being true, why, again, do you say that you do not see a future for the radical revisionist theology of the liberals within the United Methodist Church?
Well, because conservatives have begun to acquire legislative control at the General Conference, the last several General Conferences, and that is slowly leading to encroachments on the liberal control of the last 40 or 50 years over the permanent church bureaucracy. And so I see that the liberals will be slowly, over the next 8, 12, 20 years, losing control over the church's missions board, over the church's lobby office in Washington, the publishing house, etc. We've seen it already in the composition of the bishops in the U.S. A number of Orthodox bishops were elected this year. And so I think that as the liberal regions of the church continue to lose ground in terms of numbers, they will no longer be able to retain majorities on the boards of directors of church agencies. And eventually that will translate into what happens in the seminaries as well.
Now, it's well known that the Episcopal Church USA, even with the mitigating influence of non-Western Anglicans, decided it was going to take the step of ordaining an actively gay bishop this last year. Now, compare and contrast the United Methodist Church and the Episcopal Church USA with regard to their direction and, at least apparently, their future.
Well, they are going in two different directions, and once again, a large part of the explanation is the African component of the Methodist Church. The difference being, in terms of organization, the Episcopal Church USA is exactly that. Its convention, when it meets, is almost all delegates from the U.S. The Worldwide Anglican Communion is an informal gathering of all of the Anglican churches around the world, but the overseas Anglicans have no direct legal vote in the affairs of the Episcopal Church USA. The United Methodist Church, previously 20%, now as of recent action, 30% of our denomination now lives outside the U.S. So our governing body, when it meets, that means that 30% of the delegates will be from outside of the U.S. and will be voting just like the U.S. delegates. And that gives evangelicals the advantage of having those overseas allies right there at their side voting with them.
So it has to do really with kind of the practical polity of these two churches respectively, because if the African element of the Anglican Communion actually had a voice in what was going on in the American branch of the church, then they certainly would have forestalled or perhaps even squashed altogether the effort to have an openly gay clergy in that church.
Oh, absolutely. There are only 2 million members of the Episcopal Church in the U.S. There are 70 million members of the Anglican Communion around the world, almost all of them Orthodox and conservative. There are probably about 70 million Methodists around the world, mostly in autonomous churches, but 11 million are in the United Methodist Church. And 8 million of those are U.S. people, and 3 million are overseas people. So having those 3 million non-U.S. Methodists in our denomination has been a tremendous boost to those of us on the Orthodox side.
I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. In about 15 minutes, we'll talk to John Leo of U.S. News and World Report. We're going to be talking to him about why voters in the heartland vote their values often over their pocketbooks. Right now we're discussing the United Methodist Church's General Conference and the influence of African Methodists in that conference. Mark Tooley is our guest. He's director of the United Methodist Action Committee for the Institute on Religion and Democracy based in Washington, D.C. Their website address, ird-renew.org, ird-renew.org. Let's get into some specifics about the mindset of African Methodists. How would you typify it?
Well, unlike American Methodists, who are 7 or 8 generations away from John Wesley, spiritually the African Methodists are only 1 generation away from John Wesley, in that they almost all are comprised of converts to Christianity, first-generation converts, or are the children of converts. Their churches, by and large, were founded just in the last 30 or 40 or 50 years and only have been growing dramatically for the last 20 years or so. And so they very much are still fueled by a Wesleyan evangelistic fervor that keeps them very close to the Bible and to traditional teachings.
You have some very telling quotes from the various delegates from African countries and sectors of the United Methodist Church. One of them, they're so common sense. One of them, a delegate from Congo, says, "I'm wondering," with reference to the sexuality question, "I'm wondering by what mechanism what the church yesterday considered to be a sin can now turn today and make it into a God-blessed practice." How would you answer his question?
Well, and of course, many of the African delegates argued that the Christian missionaries, when they came to Africa, persuaded them to give up polygamy in favor of marriage as one man, one woman. And now they say that here Western Christians are trying to tell them that marriage can also be man-man or woman-woman. And, of course, they find that to be absurd, and rightly so.
Could there also be an element in some African countries, not necessarily all the ones that we were discussing here, in some African countries, the AIDS crisis due to promiscuous heterosexual sex but also homosexuality has reached not just epidemic proportion but almost the kind of proportions that make it a medieval plague proportion?
Well, I had not thought of that, but very likely that could be the case. Some of the Methodist churches in Africa are in Mozambique and Zimbabwe and Angola, countries severely affected by the AIDS crisis, and they're seeing firsthand the results of promiscuous sexual behavior. So very possibly that has affected the thinking of the churches there.
Now, another issue raised by the African delegates is the simple issue of sin. How does that play into their thinking on these issues when it comes to the United Methodist Church?
Well, for them, the definition of sin is a very obvious one. It's whatever the scriptures condemn as being at odds with God's will, which, of course, according to both Old and New Testaments, would include homosexual practice along with other non-marital sexual practices, and they hold to a traditional Christian understanding of the fallen nature of mankind and the need for redemption through the blood atonement of Jesus Christ, which is the heart of the issue of our division within the church, not sex, but our understanding of human nature and of who God is. The liberal side of Methodism, of course, does not believe that people are fallen, are sinful. They believe that people are basically good. And so they see no need for adhering to a doctrine of blood atonement or salvation by faith. They believe the church's purpose is more humanitarian and social and political action.
So the debate over human sexuality in the United Methodist Church is really just a symptom of a far greater, deeper theological rift.
Well, that's correct. And unfortunately, rather than having a full-blown, honest debate on those core theological differences, instead conservatives and liberals divide over the issue of homosexuality.
Now, I read this quote from one of the delegates there, this one, I think, from the Congo. This is a Liberian delegate. He says, "I don't think the United Methodist Church can license people to go to hell. It is a sin that leads to hell, and the church must speak against every kind of sin." And I imagine the liberal element of the United Methodist Church kind of chuckling at the naivete of someone who would still believe in sin and hell, the consequences of sin.
Well, that's correct. And at our church governing bodies, even the Orthodox, the conservatives, feel that politically they must speak in very soft, therapeutic language, non-judgmental language. But the Africans are removed from that political need, and they were very blunt and outspoken and were able to speak in that way because liberals who would eagerly brand American Christians as bigots for speaking in that way, they know they cannot use that same language against African Christians.
That's the irony that you point out in your Touchstone article, that it is the liberals who have prided themselves, as you say, being advocates for the oppressed third world. And here's the third world saying, "We don't like your theology."
Well, Well, that's absolutely right. I think that liberals have felt very flummoxed and cornered by the position they've placed themselves in that for decades they have, whether through liberation theology or other causes, portrayed themselves as the chief champions of persecuted third world believers. But now, liberals, for liberals, the foremost issue of the day is homosexuality, and they are on a completely different side of that issue from their sensible friends in the third world, and they're not quite sure how to react to that politically.
So what do you expect to happen, not only in the next 4 years, but in the next decades, to the United Methodist Church, if you are going to prognosticate about what it would look like on these issues? Where would you put the United Methodist Church, say, in 20 years?
Well, assuming that those on the evangelical conservative side in the U.S. don't simply grow weary and tired and exhausted from the battles, assuming that most stay the course, I believe that our majority will increase over the coming years to the point that the liberal reasons of the church will become demographically almost irrelevant. And the question will become at that point is, will the remaining liberal parts of the church, will they want to remain in the denomination or not wanting to lose their autonomy and having lost their power, not wanting to operate as a minority, will they accede to some kind of a formal, amicable separation that would give them their own denomination?
Could we see either a remnant of, large remnant of, or perhaps even the United Methodist Church in general returning to its Wesleyan roots, theologically, in the next several decades?
Well, that is my hope and my dream, and I think it already is happening internationally. The question is, will it happen here in the U.S.? And my hope is that the influence of our African brothers and sisters is going to demographically and politically pull us along in that direction, especially as we witness very vividly the collapse, the demographic collapse of theological liberalism in the U.S. and throughout the Western world.
Mark Tooley is director of the United Methodist Action Committee for the Institute on Religion and Democracy, based in Washington, D.C. Their website, ird-renew.org. He's also author of an article in the latest Touchstone magazine titled Light from the Dark Continent. Mark, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
When we come back from this break, we are going to pick up our conversation with John Leo. Now, the book is out called What's the Matter with Kansas? It's a book by Thomas Frank. He is a little befuddled at why Heartland voters are voting their values rather than their pocketbook, and sometimes voting for candidates that, if you look at it, you know, simply in terms of dollars and cents, are not to the advantage of Heartland voters. Not necessarily just voting Republican, but they're voting for people who, at least in economic terms, wouldn't necessarily be the best thing for the Heartland voter. Why are they voting for them? Apparently, it's the issue of values. Let's see if we can clear up the confusion, not only for Thomas Frank, but also for the rest of us, when John Leo joins us on the other side of the break. Then we'll round off that second hour talking with Joe Starrs about pro-choice Roman Catholic politicians.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
People all over the world, people of every religion, pray. But Christian prayer is different. What is Christian prayer? How do Christians know that God both hears and answers their prayers? What does it really mean to pray in Jesus' name? In our Issues, Etc. book of the month for August, Is God Listening?, Dr. Andrew Steinman answers those questions. You can order Is God Listening?, our Issues, Etc. book of the month for August, by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section for the Issues, Etc. book of the month for August, Is God Listening? By Dr. Andrew Steinman. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Charges of media bias are a little harder to deny today following an incident with Reuters News Service. A routine news release by the National Right to Life Committee prompted a hostile reply from an editor at the International News Service. Stuart Shepard reports.
In response to the pro-life group's email, Todd Eastham, a Washington editor for Reuters, wrote, "What's your plan for parenting and educating all the unwanted children you people want to bring into the world? Who will pay for policing our streets and maintaining the prisons needed to contain them when you, their parents, and the system fail them?" With the vulgarity, he adds, "Give me a break." Reuters spokesman Stephen Nauru made it clear he's offering no excuse.
This was a personal opinion that unfortunately was issued by this person, you know, in his capacity as a desk editor.
Some folks might wonder if an editor who so vocally expressed his antagonism for pro-lifers could be regarded as capable of fair and unbiased reporting.
Well, that's exactly why we are, looking into it even further.
He says Eastham is being disciplined. Douglas Johnson at National Right to Life received the nasty email.
This man is a news editor. He's supposed to be reviewing other reporters' copy for bias or lack of balance. One has to wonder whether these vehement opinions that he would feel so free to so casually and gratuitously express would color that process of editing.
He says Eastham was likely just expressing verbally what a lot of Washington journalists say to each other privately. He thinks it reflects a culture of bias that colors news coverage on the abortion issue. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepard.
The news release that sparked the email was a response to a court decision on the federal partial birth abortion ban. Eastham's email also took a shot at George W. Bush. Eastham did not reply to our request for an interview. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Is this how you feel as a parent? Like a frightened chicken, afraid the sky might fall on your family any moment? Focus on the Family with Dr. James Dobson can help keep you from chickening out on your most vital role, being the parent your kids need most. Keep parenting in perspective with Focus on the Family, heard weekdays right here.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Does God communicate to us in prayer? Find out with our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August. It's titled, Is God Listening? By Dr. Andrew Steinman. For more information, check out our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $9.99 plus shipping and handling. Is God Listening? An in-depth study on prayer. 1-800-325-3040.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Our guest for the next few minutes, John Leo of U.S. News & World Report. We're going to be talking with him about social conservatives, and then we'll be talking with Joe Starrs about pro-choice Roman Catholic politicians and the Republican National Convention. Who is it tonight? Arnold Schwarzenegger is going to be there, and Governor Pataki. No, he's going to come on the same night, or maybe Wednesday or Thursday night. We'll be talking with Joe Starrs about that in just a few minutes. Then open lines in the third hour for your questions and your comments. Hear a little bit there from President Bill Clinton as he talks about seeing through a mirror dimly. John Leo is a regular guest on the program. He's columnist for U.S. News and World Report, and he's author of a column in the latest issue of the news magazine titled Pain in the Heartland. John, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
You begin your column talking about Thomas Frank's new book, What's the Matter with Kansas?
Right.
What has got Thomas Frank confused?
He thinks that voters in Kansas and everywhere else should vote primarily on economic issues and that they shouldn't waste their votes on social issues. He underrates the importance of social issues to many of us who care very much about them.
Now, so he's trying to make the case that Heartland voters are ignoring their financial interests when they vote for social conservatives? Is that what he's trying to say?
I think so. To be fair to Frank, he's talking about how far behind Kansas is falling and the Great Plains in general. He's talking about dying ranches, dying small towns, and that people do not use their votes to get better economic state. I agree with that. Whether you vote Republican or Democratic, you should see some economic payoff for the way you elect people. But he consistently underrates and, in fact, insults people who believe in social issues. That, like so many people who stress his economics, he's just tone deaf to issues that create the culture and people who care about the culture and the ability of their kids to be raised in a traditional environment don't feel the same way he does about voting.
So, John, let's clear up the confusion, at least for our listeners. Why is it that Heartland voters are voting their values rather than their pocketbooks necessarily in every case?
Well, I can judge from my mail. I think a lot of people feel a lot of pain from what's happened to the culture. Now, some of it is unavoidable change, but some of it is also engineered by what I call the new morality that America has changed to the point where patriotism is mocked, community is underrated, the traditional family is considered a stumbling block or an obstacle to progress. And everywhere that parents look, whether it's Hollywood or the schools, their values are not celebrated. And they look around and they're desperate that their kids get an education that they consider important, and they're getting exactly the opposite value system pumped into them by the opposition.
You also point out that the Republican political dominance that has prevailed, well, in one form or another, one might argue prevailed in one form or another for almost a decade now or more, hasn't had a lot of impact in slowing down this cultural shift.
It's amazing, isn't it? I think it would be, you'd have to say 30 years. I think it started with the 1968 convention and the battle between the kids and the cops. And I think people were really upset by the counterculture and how it was beginning to invade the entire culture. We thought at the time that it was just about sex and drugs and rock and roll, but it pervaded every aspect of our culture, from the courts to the schools to the way we discuss issues. And I think people are waking up to that. But the amazing thing, as I said before, is that we have had 30 years of political dominance by the right and cultural dominance by the left. It's an odd arrangement. And that just increases the polarization in my point of view.
Is this just another way of talking about what has been called now for some time the culture war?
Sure, it is. It is. So the culture war is about the values that we live by and that our country lives by and that our children are raised in. And a lot of us were very pleased that traditional culture seemed to make a comeback after 9/11 when we realized that a manly virtues that the police and firemen showed and the willingness to help out. People drove across the country, I'm sure from Kansas too, to help out, that kind of spirit of giving and oneness of the American people. But now people have faded back to their usual lines of battle. And on the left, community doesn't count for very much, and patriotism is considered a joke. And they look to, you know, the elites look to Europe. They think of themselves as members of a world culture. And when they think about America at all, they think of something that's evil, patriarchal, domineering, judges by slavery and the Indian Wars. And so you have a war that's permanently in the American people. Which view of America are you going to take, a positive, optimistic one, or kind of sneering America's wrong ethic?
Now, I got one. There seems to be an anomaly here that I would like an explanation for. President Bill Clinton ran and won at least the first time on the phrase, it's the economy, stupid, on people's pocketbook issues. And one might argue, in terms of financial success, whether it was him cooperating with Republicans or not, there were some real economic gains during his 8 years. How does that fit into this picture? Did people take a break from voting for their values during that time?
I don't think so. I think economics are important. I don't mean to deride that. But I think that Clinton understood, as a very smart politician, he understood the power of the cultural issues. I mean, he touched on them all the time. 100,000 new police, school uniforms here, patriotism lauded there. He understood where the touch points were for the traditional culture and how worried people were. And even though he is of the party of the left, he did pull the Democrats toward the middle. And so he really was aware of the issues of the culture war.
Finally, John, the saddest thing that I found in your column, and I'll put it in your words and ask you to explain, is you say ordinary Americans no longer feel that they can transmit their culture to their young. What do you mean?
Well, I think that's right. I think that it's partly belief in God, partly belief in traditional values, that the family is important, that divorce is not a new beginning or a healthy state. It's a failure of marriage, and that we shouldn't celebrate that. And that same-sex marriage, to many of us, has an eerie ring. It just is not what marriage is. So a lot of these issues are introducing new values under cover of bias legislation. You know, if you're not for gay marriage, you're biased. But I'm not biased. I have many gay friends. I just think that that's not what a marriage is. So you vote your values, and you don't get hammered by the rest of the culture. But there's no doubt that the media, the people who do all the talking and set the agenda, are on the other side.
Where do you see this going, the culture war in general, but also the voting trends of people who vote their values rather than their pocketbooks?
Well, as I say at the end, I think there's new ammunition for those who think in terms of traditional culture. The new media seem to me very strongly on the traditional side. The bloggers I read on the Internet, the Internet weblogs, they are terrific. There are some on the left, of course, but the strongest and most hard-hitting ones are on the right. And when you combine that with talk radio and Fox News and a resurgent conservative press, I think there's hope that the traditional values will do better.
Folks, you can read John Leo's weekly column for U.S. News and World Report on the web at usnews.com, usnews.com. John, thanks for being our guest again.
Thank you, Todd.
John Leo is a columnist for U.S. News and World Report and author of this column in the latest issue of the magazine titled Pain in the Heartland. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to spend a few minutes with Joe Starr as a regular guest. We're going to be talking about pro-choice Roman Catholic politicians, and we'll also talk about the Republican National Convention. Joe Starr is director of the Crusade for the Defense of Our Catholic Church campaign for the American Life League. Joe, welcome back.
Thank you.
Joe, first of all, let's name names. Who are some of the prominent pro-choice Roman Catholic politicians at the Republican National Convention?
Sure. Well, Governor George Pataki of New York, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Senator Susan Collins, those are just to name a few. Rudy Giuliani, of course. Those are the most prominent ones.
All right. Now, how should the pro-life voter be looking at this? I've heard a lot of people say, look, they're up there because the Republicans are going to try and appeal to the more moderate, middle-of-the-road voter who may not be committed yet. How should they see the prominence of these pro-choice Roman Catholic politicians at the RNC convention?
I think pro-lifers ought to be very nervous, and they ought to be very unhappy, because anytime you're going to put your best foot forward, that would be the people who stood behind you, the people who've done the dirty work for you. And to put up a slate of moderates like this, I think, sends a terrible message. And pro-lifers should not and will not be taken for granted by any political party.
Now, I want to talk about this. I believe it is an ad, the New Deadly Dozen. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is 12 pro-abortion Catholic politicians. Most of them are members of the United States Senate, including the senator from Massachusetts. There is the other four Republicans that I mentioned. Nancy Pelosi is on there. But these are some of the most powerful members of Congress, some of the most powerful Catholic politicians out there. And the reason that we released this ad today was to point out two things. One, that you cannot be pro-abortion and Catholic, and two, that the Catholic bishops of the United States need to be more proactive and to engage and confront and, if necessary, deny Holy Communion to these pro-abortion Catholic politicians.
Let's name names again. Who are the deadly dozen in this ad?
Sure. We have a total, starting with Senator John Kerry, tops the list, Edward Kennedy, Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa, Senator Dick Durbin, Senator Christopher Dodd, Senator Susan Collins, Senator Patrick Leahy, Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican from Alaska, Senator Barbara Mikulski from Maryland, U.S. Representative Nancy Pelosi, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Governor George Pataki. Those are your deadly dozen. And the reason why we use the term deadly is because they advocate the killing of children in the womb. People don't like to hear that. People think that's being divisive, but that's the truth of the matter.
So, and we should point out here that that list is about 50-50 Republican and Democrat, isn't it?
It's there's about four Republicans and eight Democrats. So, you know, God bless the Republican Party. It's our there are more Democrats than there are Republicans. So it's not 50-50 exactly.
The other feature of this ad that I found quite interesting is that there's contact information for officials in the Roman Catholic Church connected to each one of these candidates featured in the Deadly Dozen ad, isn't there?
There is, and we want every bishop of every politician to contact that politician to get a hold of Governor Pataki, who I think is coming up the road right now as we speak, and confront them and say, look, if you want to be Catholic, if you want to call yourself a pro-abortion Catholic, then you can't come to communion. So, yeah, this is really in the hands of the bishops in a lot of ways.
So it's the bishops who the ad is designed to get those who see it to contact the bishops themselves.
Correct. And every bishop will get a copy of this ad. And, yes, hopefully the message will get through to each of the Senator Durbin and Senator Kerry and all the other bishops of these politicians.
Now, someone might say, look, Joe, Rick Santorum, probably the most pro-life and most prominent pro-life senator and Roman Catholic in the Senate, is being given a place there at the Republican National Convention. How do you respond?
Well, I'm glad that Senator Santorum was given a slot, but, you know, it wasn't exactly a prime time spot. But again, when you invite guests over to your house, you put out the best china, and you want to put your best foot forward. And frankly, I don't think the lineup is what is the best of what the Republican Party has to offer.
Okay. I want to know your expectations. We were talking with our listeners yesterday about this, Joe. Their expectations as the Republican convention started for what the president would be saying in his acceptance speech. Do you expect him to mention abortion?
I do expect him to mention abortion, and the reason I expect him is because millions and millions of pro-lifers voted for him because of that. So, yes, I do expect him to mention it.
Let's do some statistics, too. How many Roman Catholics are there in the United States?
There's close to 64 million.
And how many of those are practicing Catholics?
Well, there's about 22%.
So if you were going to give a percentage to Catholics in name only, what would it be?
I would say, back that up. It's closer to 30% are not Catholics in name only, so it's closer to almost more than half, actually.
So do you think that the prominent pro-choice Roman Catholic politicians, be they either Republican or Democrat, are counting on the fact that there are so many Roman Catholics in the United States who are not practicing and perhaps are not taking their church's teaching on life seriously?
I'm sure that's part of their calculus, but, that doesn't negate the responsibility of the bishops, and that doesn't negate our responsibility to call those and our brothers and sisters forward and to move out from where they are.
So how important would you say the life issue is to Roman Catholics?
I think for Catholics who attend Mass every Sunday, it's number one. And the less practicing you are, the less important it is. And every poll has been polled that mirror that opinion.
Oh, then how do you respond to, let's take the argument of Senator John Kerry as he runs for president, when he's been confronted on the issue of communion and his the disparity between his position and that of his church on the issue of life? He says, I believe life begins at conception, but, and I'm a good practicing Roman Catholic, but I don't think that my religious views should dictate how I legislate or how I would govern as president. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, the support of the unborn is not a religious issue. It's a civil rights issue. I think Senator Kerry is hiding behind what he says that.
Would you say that one more time? Well, you broke up a little bit.
Oh, I said, I think Senator Kerry is hiding behind his position that support of the unborn is a civil rights issue. It's not a religious issue at all.
How do you respond to the argument made by the former governor of New York, Mario Cuomo, who said, look, I'm pro-life, but what I disagree with is the means by which we make abortion unthinkable. I'm going to take a different track. I'm going to be pro-life, but I might take a more circuitous route to get there.
The Pope says that a support of an evil law is not acceptable. And if Senator Kerry or Governor Cuomo has done anything to limit abortion in any way, I'd like to see it. I don't see it, and I haven't seen it.
You quote canon law in this ad, the Dirty Dozen ad. Tell us about it.
Canon law 915 is a church law that says any person who persists in manifest grave sin shall not be admitted to Holy Communion. That's the law of the Catholic Church based on teaching from the Bible.
So what should the bishops do if they're going to remain steadfast to canon law and the teaching of the church? What should they do with pro-choice Roman Catholic politicians?
They should sit down with them, and they should very lovingly but very firmly say, look, your position for abortion places you outside the teachings of the Catholic Church, places you outside the body of Christ, and therefore I do not want you to go to Holy Communion until you've repented, publicly repented of your sin. They can go to Mass, but they simply cannot take Holy Communion, and that's what every bishop, I believe, should do, and more bishops are doing just that. Three bishops in the South in August issued a decree that barred all pro-abortion Catholic politicians from receiving Holy Communion, so it is being done by other bishops.
Do you expect other bishops to follow suit on those three?
I do expect it. I think Archbishop Raymond Burke from St. Louis was the first one. The bishops from the South, they're following. I think it will happen, absolutely.
Some might say that there could be a backlash from the government if the church begins to discipline politicians fully within the church's canons and decrees, but if they begin to discipline politicians by barring them from communion, there could be a government backlash. How do you respond?
Well, I would respond by saying this, that if the government wants to crack down on Catholics, then we'll close our hospitals, we'll close our AIDS hospices, we'll close our schools, and then what will the government do? The Catholic Church takes care of the poor and is the largest provider of the underprivileged in the United States. And so if the government wants to take on the church, bring them on. We're going to stand by our principles regardless of any governmental threats.
So how is President George W. Bush's, how is his faith-based initiative, how is it going along with the Roman Catholic aims there? Is it going to be on the same page with the Roman Catholic Church on these issues?
You know, I think that any time you infuse faith into the public square, this is a good thing. I don't know how many bishops or Catholic officials will support it, but I think any time that faith is allowed back into the public square. Notice I said back into the public square. That's a good thing. So I'm sure that most Catholics would support it.
We're talking about pro-choice Roman Catholic politicians and the Republican National Convention. Joe Starrs is our guest, director of the Crusade for the Defense of Our Catholic Church campaign for the American Life League. He joins us live from New York, where the convention is taking place. Is human life, the defense of human life, a partisan issue?
Absolutely not. Defense of human life is an issue that all people of all faiths, those without faith, should be concerned about. If we're not going to defend innocent human life, what kind of country are we? Where are we headed? So it is not a partisan issue at all.
Where did the ads, the Deadly Dozen ads, run today, and what do you hope the overall result will be of these ads?
Yeah, we ran in the Washington Times, national edition, and we hope that that just people will. It's really hard to hear. Sorry if I'm shouting. We hope that that Catholics and Protestants and Jews and people of all faith will just come and realize that support of abortion is wrong, and that it's time to stand up for the children in the womb.
Finally, Joe, give me your best guess. What percentage will President Bush receive from the electorate among Catholic voters in November?
I would guess that more than half of Catholics will vote for George Bush.
Will it be because of the life issue?
Yes, absolutely.
Folks, you can find out more about not only the Crusade for the Defense of Our Catholic Church for the campaign for the American Life League, but also these ads on the web. The web address is www.all.org. www.all.org. That's the website for the American Life League. Joe, thanks for being our guest again.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Joe Starr is director of the Campaign for the Defense of Our Catholic Church campaign for the American Life League. I want you to note something here, folks. The best possible outcome. You could say, well, the best possible outcome would be to vote the bums out. No. No. The best possible outcome would be repentance. That would be the best possible outcome. First of all, that the bishops would get off their tail ends and do what they promised they would do when they took their vows as bishops. That they would exercise the proper discipline that their church has given them the authority to exercise. And not that it would simply frustrate people or say, okay, we scored one for the pro-life side, but that these politicians, for that matter, every Roman Catholic who is pro-choice, every Christian who is either out of ignorance or out of willful ignorance, pro-choice, would repent. The issue isn't so much whether or not they're lawmakers. The question is, will they listen to their church and to the clear teaching of God's word when it comes to the life issue and the defense of life? The best possible outcome is repentance on the part of all. When we come back from this break, we've got open lines for your questions and comments in the third hour of the program. Open lines, as usual, is anything you want to talk about. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Those are our call-in numbers. Now, you can call during this break as well. We're going to be hearing from some of the goings-on at the Republican National Convention. This is what I think shouldn't have happened last night. Some prayers were said. And I have no problem with prayers being said. And these prayers, as a number of themselves, are fine. They were prayed sincerely, I'm sure. But I think they were put on the docket of the Republican National Convention for entirely the wrong reasons. We'll talk about it when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.